When moving forward seems too much. When you feel totally out of touch. Hope is seeping out the door. You find yourself curled on the floor. The thoughts swirl round all jumbled and messed. Why is this brain so darkly obsessed? I've secrets I've never confessed. Haven't told the soul I am pressed. The gentle whisper through the pain. Remember rainbows follow rain. Breathe deeply, hold on tight. Your hope will return, shining
bright.
Embrace now real past. And give us peace, that you're not. Reach out, let your strength be shown.
Now, let's start the show. So, it's really wonderful to be here this afternoon, and I am going to, without further ado, let you get to know our guest, Mallory Tenori Tarte. Hi there.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for being my guest. I very much appreciate that.
Of course, looking forward to the conversation.
Oh, I'm glad. So let's start with, why don't you give us a little bit of an insight into who Mallory is and what you do?
Sure. So I am a journalism professor at the University of Texas at Austin, and I'm the author of a new memoir that's coming out in August titled Slip. And this is a book that I've been working on for probably more than half my life, but it's really been in the past 5 years that I've been working on this latest iteration. And it's really a blend of my own personal experiences with an eating disorder and research, which I did over the course of about 5 years, where I interviewed and surveyed lots of other people who had lived experience with eating disorders, as well as researchers and clinicians. And so just the cliff note version is that the book explores what I call the middle place, which is essentially this name I've given to this space in between acute sickness and full recovery from an eating disorder. And for me, it's been really interesting exploring these questions of what does it mean to be better, but not all better? And what does it mean to still live with the imprints of your disorder? And I think those questions are relevant for folks who have eating disorders, but also relevant for people struggling with all different types of mental illnesses.
You hit the nail right on the head. Absolutely. This will be a very interesting conversation. And I know before we even start that anything, chronic illness or eating disorder or mental health condition, all of those things have the same ebb and flow, the same timeline. And it's interesting because I don't think that we often think about eating disorders the same way we think about mental health issues, and certainly not in the concept of possibly being suicidal, having ideation, and suicide loss in total. It's actually unfortunate that it can be very often the end result, and very happy to say, not in your case, which is wonderful, but wow, I can't wait to see the book, because that's something that very much interests me, eating disorder piece, because there are a number of different places on a spectrum of eating disorders that all can ultimately lead to the same issues. which I think is pretty interesting. And that's all I'm going to say now. I'm going to let you go ahead and give us a timeline. Go back and give us an idea of what precipitated this. How old were you and how did it progress?
Sure. So when I was 8, my mom was diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer and was sick for about 3 years. And so during that time, my family really held on to this belief that my mother was going to be okay and that she was going to make it. We often talked about my mother being a soldier in a battle or being the little engine that could. And the common refrain was that she was going to come out the other side victorious and she would get to the other side of that mountain. And it's very clear in looking back at my mom's old medical records, which I obtained when writing the book, that she was not going to make it. I did not realize that, though, as a young child. And so when the cancer spread to her bone marrow and her liver and her brain, she ultimately did end up passing away when I was 11. And after she passed away, I continued to feel like I needed to be okay and pretend that I was fine. That was something I did when she was sick, probably partly because I'm a perfectionist. But even after she passed away, I went to school the day after she died. I wrote her eulogy and didn't cry at all and really tried to put on this happy face because I thought that was what I was supposed to do. I really didn't know what it meant to grieve, but inside it felt like I was crumbling. And the more time passed, the farther I felt from my mother. And I found myself wanting to stop time in ways. And around the same time, I was in a 7th grade health class where I was learning about eating disorders and we were being taught about quote unquote good foods and bad foods. And I was learning that you could change the way your body looked depending on the food you put into it. And it was around this time when I was 12 when I began to conjure up this idea that maybe somehow if I stayed the same size my mother was when she was alive, I could become closer to her. For me, food restriction was this almost warped form of time travel. And it was never about being skinny. I think a lot of times we have misconceptions that everyone with an eating disorder just wants to be skinny. It was really about trying to stay small and safe. And of course, the irony of eating disorders is that we think they'll give us one thing, but they end up stripping that completely from us. So the eating disorder left me feeling farther away from my mother than ever before and more out of control than ever before.
And yeah, and I think an awful lot of that has to do with that control, because when we lose, as young as you were to lose your mom, all of the pieces that you just spoke about, writing the eulogy, it's all a form of trying to control the narrative in your life. Did you have siblings?
No, so I'm an only child, so that made it a little bit more complicated as well.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. That's losing one's mother is huge, but losing your mom when you are an only child is, it's like having part of you ripped asunder. Yeah, that's sort of, I'm so sorry. And you were so very young. And how long, from 12 to what age, were you managing appearances?
So for a while, when I was in the 7th grade, I was restricting my food intake and my father could tell that something was off because I no longer wanted to get pizza with him or go out for ice cream. And I wasn't eating the foods that we had once enjoyed together as a family. But my father didn't really know what it was that I was grappling with because his only point of reference for eating disorders was the death of singer-songwriter Karen Carpenter, who had died of complications from anorexia in 1983. And in his mind, because of that, he thought that it was only adults who struggled with eating disorders. And I didn't really have the words to describe what it was that I was struggling with either. And my father had tried to take me to our pediatrician, but the pediatrician essentially told him that it was just a passing phase that I was going through. And that speaks to some larger, broader systemic issues around lack of training on eating disorders in the medical field. But we ended up having to go back to this pediatrician who essentially told us the same thing 6 months later. And by that point, I was almost a year into struggling with what we later came to know was an eating disorder. So it wasn't until my father took me to Boston Children's Hospital in Massachusetts that the doctors looked at me and said, you have anorexia nervosa. And so it was the first time we actually had words to describe what it was I was struggling with. And for about a stretch of 3 years, I was hospitalized 5 times and in residential treatment for a year and a half. So was very much in this cycle of moving in and out of treatment. And it wasn't until residential treatment that I really began to work through my grief and to really start to make progress in my recovery. I think I needed that time and that space away from home to really be able to work through the eating disorder. And I'm really grateful that I was able to do that. Fortunately, my public school district paid for all of my treatment. Otherwise, I never would have been able to stay in treatment for that long. But that was a very difficult stretch, as you can imagine, for me and my whole family.
Yeah. I can just imagine what was going through your poor father's head. I only have one child and I'm not providing for her. That's got to be a whole different dynamic. But it's unfortunate that because we don't have, or we're starting to, but we've never had an understanding of grief because it's not something we discuss. Grief, loss, and eating disorders have never been in the mainstream as far as conversation is concerned.
Yes, and I feel like grief is very private and we don't talk about it enough. And often it's framed as something that's quite linear. There's still talk, the 5 stages of grief, as if there's this very neat and tidy way of grieving. And yet for many of us, grief is something we hold for a lifetime, right? The loss of that, or the load of that loss lightens, but it's still there.
Yeah, I liken grief to a train. And we get on and off the grief train in our lifetime, depending on how many people we lose. Some people don't ever get off in between, but after a while, you learn through how your grief ebbs and flows that you're able to, you know, work alongside or help somebody else on the train with you, so that they too can manage their grief. And it is not something that has a time. I don't know how many times I've talked to people. Years ago, it wasn't even a human. I lost a puppy. We had taken in a sick puppy and we ended up losing the puppy. And unfortunately, she fell into the pool and it was... in no time, she had a seizure. And losing that puppy was devastating. But a very dear friend, who I have not talked to in years, about 5 weeks later said, okay, come on, tick, tick. Like, when are you getting over this? And it was like someone threw cold water on me. I don't know that I'll ever be over it. But it was part of my... really examining what is it that people expect? What exactly is grief? And why do people think that they can put a time limit on how long you hurt? There's no time limit on how long we love people. So why would there be one on the grief of losing them? It's horrible that as children, there's no one really to talk to you about managing your grief, because although it won't ever go away, you are always going to have some grief. It can become manageable, and there are ways to savor your memories and to make sure that you can keep the essence of the person you lost alive by continuing with their memory and talking about them And it's just so sad to me that we never, ever have done that. If people die, you have a funeral. Okay, that's done. That's okay. Now that's gone away. And it's like that with anything that is a difficult subject. I believe eating disorders are right in there. I'm a lot older than you. I'm going to be 70 in November. So as a child, I remember hearing Carpenter losing her life. And as a child, when was someone in the family that had a mental health issue, you didn't say anything. I worked at a huge facility. It was basically called an asylum. And I volunteered there from the time I was 12. And at 15, I was hired for the summer. These were all things and places that people didn't talk about. I thought it was wonderful that I got to go to work, and but I couldn't really tell people because they look at you weird and you're doing what? Oh, why would you go there or help people? It wasn't something that was said or done or talked about. And eating disorders back then, there were people that were in the facility. Okay, I can see a young lady. And I used to think, wouldn't you feel better at home? And it, just something that goes through your head. My point in all that is all of these things for so many generations, we have kept a lid on everything and didn't talk about it, didn't examine it. And we expect kids to get through life with losing a parent. Or I had a girlfriend I went to school with whose mom was locked away for issues, and she wasn't allowed to talk about it.
It's so hard.
Yeah, and it's just so terribly sad, and that's part of the reason we do the podcast, because when you share your burden, it lightens your load somewhat. It also lets other people know they're not alone.
Yes, that is such a big part of why I wrote this book, just to help people to feel seen and heard. And it's the book that I wish I'd had when I was struggling, because so often as a writer, I would turn to books for guidance and solace. And while many of the books on eating disorders were helpful, I always felt like there was this lack of a mirrored image, and that left me feeling really misunderstood and alone, because most of the books were written by clinicians, or they were written from the perspective of people who were fully recovered and who had ostensibly gotten past their eating disorder. And for me, as someone who still lives with the imprints of my disorder and who still contends with some of the behaviors, I really wanted a book that grappled with that and explored that in-between space where you're not acutely sick anymore, but you're also not recovered with a capital R. And so in talking with other people for this book and doing lots of interviews, I realized that there's so many other people navigating this middle place, but they never really felt like they could share their story because there was a lot of stigma and shame in admitting that they weren't yet fully recovered.
And in all honesty, I don't think there's anything we go through that we fully recover. You recover from mumps or the measles. It has a time frame. But the big things in life, the emotional stuff, eating disorders and depression and anxiety and ideation, they're not things you completely heal from. They are always a part of you, and you can find yourself falling back into certain behaviors. To me, it's like addiction, because whether it's drink or it's drugs or it's food or whatever you're addicted to, there always have to be an internal vigilance, I think.
I think so, too. And I think that the addiction community has actually done a better job of expanding the verbiage for talking about recovery. So it's much more common for folks, for instance, in Alcoholics Anonymous to say, I'm a recovering alcoholic or I'm in recovery. And I think the eating disorder field has come a long way, but I think that there still is a lot of stigma and shame around this verbiage of being in recovery. And the field really has for so long pushed full recovery and recovered, period. And so I think that can be really problematic at times, especially when you consider that folks with eating disorders do tend to be perfectionists. That is one of the temperament traits that is very common among people with eating disorders. And so this notion of full recovery can often feel like this perfectionistic ideal that is really hard to maintain over any length of time.
Oh, absolutely. And the least little slip could precipitate something worse because you're perfect.
Yes, exactly. And that's why I titled the book Slip, because I felt like there is so much shame around this idea of slipping. And I remember when I got out of treatment, I tried to be the poster child for full recovery for about 2 years. I just was trying to eat perfectly and exercise and be the best student in my high school and do all the extracurriculars, but it felt exhausting. And I really was so fearful of making any wrong move because I thought, if I slip, I'm going to immediately slide back into sickness. And I didn't believe there was this space in between. So this period where I was trying to achieve this perfect full recovery was both exhausting, but also terrifying because I was so afraid of making any wrong move or slipping at all. And I used to really think of slips as grounds for failure, but now I tend to think of them more as opportunities for growth because that very word slip suggests some sort of movement. You can't slip if you're standing still. So it's an opportunity to recognize what happened and to continue, hopefully, to move forward.
I think it gives you more of an opportunity to increase your wellness rather than just stay where you were. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that very positive way of looking at things. And that's how we find ourselves in this podcast. The fact that the silence, the stigma, and the shame around so many things, it's just, I think, very difficult for humans to navigate life with everything that goes on in a day, even if you are relatively well. It still can be very hard. And when you cloak so many things in shame, it is, I think it's the hardest thing in the world for people to deal with, because it's like shining this huge spotlight on a tiny little, and you think that speck is the size of the world to everyone else. And it doesn't matter how intelligent you are. It doesn't matter how many times you tell yourself that is not so. Shame has a life of all its own.
It does. And I think that shame keeps us silent and silence keeps us stuck in sickness. And I think that when folks are in this position of just being perpetually sick or being in the early stages of the middle place and not feeling like they can seek help, then they're much more likely to stay stuck in their disorders. And the sad reality is that every year, 10,200 people will die due to complications from an eating disorder. And suicide is a leading cause of that death. There's a lot of crossover between suicide and eating disorders. And so I think the more we can have open conversations around eating disorders and about the messiness of recovery, the more we can open up spaces for people to feel safe talking about these issues.
Yeah. And I sometimes will go to things that are really important. You think of when we were little kids and we learned to walk, we kept falling down and falling down. What if, like other things, the minute we had a slip, okay, that's it. I tried it, didn't work. I think eventually the human race would stop having legs and use them. I realize that's a very simplistic view of it, but taking the power away from the shame and the stigma by laughing at it, for me, is a way to get past it and go, oh, look, the big scary monster isn't. It's just a little tiny thing, but it just yells really loud.
Yeah, it's such a good way of putting it.
Thank you. Thank you. Do you have sections for people that, like workbook type sections or things that you can, exercises they can do to get themselves further ahead?
So the book is really more narrative driven, and so it doesn't have specific workbook exercises or things of that nature. However, in the chapters about my recovery, I do talk a lot about just journaling exercises and things that I did to help me in my own recovery. And so while it's not prescriptive in the sense that I say these are the things that you should do, I hope that in hearing and reading about what I did in my treatment, that will then give other people some ideas about what they could apply to their own treatment.
So what's one of the first things you would say to someone who's coming to terms with their eating disorder? What's one of the first things that got you to take a step in the right direction?
So one thing that was really helpful for me was finding an eating disorder provider who I felt like I could trust, because I think it's difficult given that eating disorders can be so hard to understand. They're very enigmatic. And I remember as much as my father and grandmother wanted to try to help me, they were so confused by the disorder. And often they would say, just step on a scale and see that you're losing weight, or you're so smart, why can't you figure this out? Or just eat. And as a parent myself of two young children, I can completely understand where those sentiments were coming from. And I have a lot more empathy for them now as a parent myself. But it can be incredibly difficult as the child on the receiving end of those comments, because when you have an eating disorder, it's a disorder that doesn't just affect your body, but it affects your mind. And there's actually changes in the brain that happens when one is struggling with an eating disorder. And so often it feels like the disorder is so incredibly hard to control. And so for me, being able to actually seek help from a provider who was trained in eating disorders and who could understand me on a different and deeper level was really transformative in a lot of ways. Certainly that coupled with inpatient treatment was very helpful, but there are many barriers to treatment, and I realize not everybody can necessarily seek higher levels of care, but for me, that was really important. And in working with that therapist, I was able to really dig deep into the origins of my eating disorder, because I think it's easy to simplify eating disorders and say, it's just about not eating, or it's just about overeating. And it's really, at the end of the day, not so much about food, right? There's always some sort of trauma or some sort of underlying difficulty that someone is grappling with, right? And food or not eating becomes the coping mechanism. And so for me, being able to actually explore the connections between my mother's death and my eating disorder was incredibly helpful. And that then paved the way for me to be able to grieve. It also enabled me to really be able to develop other ways of coping beyond food restriction and beyond obsessive exercising. But that did not happen overnight, right? It took a very long time. Mm-hmm. And it was something that happened through an accumulation of very small baby steps. I think I've sometimes been asked, what was the main turning point in your recovery? And there really was never a turning point, but there were these little tiny pivots along the way that over time led to more substantial growth and progress.
And I think they build up and build up. So yeah, you can't refer to just one of them. It's a series of things that get you to a place where you can see vistas ahead.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. And you can actually realize that they're worthy of being seen. And I think even just that idea of seeing the vistas is so beautifully put, because for me, when I was really acutely sick, I could not see beyond my eating disorder. And I defined myself through the eating disorder. I remember distinctly when I shifted from saying I had anorexia to I am anorexic, as though it were my entire identity. And I stopped socializing, I stopped reading and writing and doing all the things that I loved. And I really couldn't see past the disorder until I really started to work through my recovery.
It's like these things, along with the shame and the stigma, it eats away your hope.
Yes.
And whatever that beastie, that's what I call it, whatever that is, that's the hardest part, is it eats away at the hope. And it's being able to return some hope. I think that gives people the opportunity to get on a road to recovery. But from my understanding, and I could be wrong, but for me, I feel that when we are triggered, however, by a trauma, and some people, you know, have an eating disorder, some people turn to addiction, some people do whatever, something that I think at the core of it all is something that you can control.
So too. Yeah.
Yeah, it seems like your world is, you know, out of order. And I hear that quite often in very different areas. It's that something that you can control, something that is not attached to anything else, but that's where you start to exert control. And it quite often really has nothing to do with path that moves forward. It can keep people stuck where they are or send them backwards. But it's just that, I guess, grasping for something to be able to manage.
Yeah, especially when you've gone through such a traumatic loss or something that just really was unexpected. And so I think, that very much was the case for me. And I remember thinking I couldn't control what happened to my mom's body, but I could control what I did to mine.
And we have to give children hope. We just have to. But our parents and our families and everyone, when someone is very ill, they try to instill, sometimes even in the person that's ill, a will to go on. And that, I think, in the end can be detrimental, because we don't teach children about possible loss. I realize it's very hard to do, but giving them some understanding of not everything goes our way all the time. And how do we cope with that? I think it's something that we need to start doing as part of education. Saying that, it's a much bigger thing, and you might be able to speak to this, is we don't talk to kids about emotions and feelings. And the fact that emotions are meant to flow and go. You're not meant to be around forever. And what is it they say? They last 30 to 90 seconds. But if you don't know that, and you're in the middle of a meltdown, you may not know that's ever going to end. And not having any tools to be able to either articulate where you're at or ask someone for help because you don't know where the hell you're at, I think it would be much better if we gave kids some of the pieces of our makeup. One of our guests here, Rex Briggs, talks about the fact that we have the most powerful supercomputer in our heads, and there are no instructions. No one's ever told you. They tell you how to ride your bike. They tell you how to play with the toys. But no one says anything about how to manage your brain.
Yeah.
And that just seems really bizarre.
Yes, it really does. And I think it is complicated by emotions, right? And figuring out how do we grapple with these. And as you were talking, it made me think about how when I was little and I would cry having to visit my mom in the hospital when she was sick, my family would say, don't cry. And my father would say, don't be sad. And I came to associate that with sadness as a negative emotion because I thought, I can't feel this way. I shouldn't feel this way. And I'm far from a perfect parent, but my kids are 7 and 9 now, and I really try hard to validate their feeling.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes with my daughter, too, I especially make note of the fact that it's okay for her to feel angry because I think societally we convey this message to women that they shouldn't be angry, they shouldn't be mad. And I try to let my kids feel the feelings and I try to validate them, but also let them realize that home is a safe space for them to share those emotions. And it's okay if they don't know why they're feeling them. Sometimes one of my kids will just have an off day, and sometimes my son will just be really frustrated all day and he can't quite articulate why. And so sometimes we just feel something and it's hard to put to words why we feel that, especially when it comes to children. And so I think just being able to sit with kids with those heavy emotions is really important because it then shows them that it's okay to feel this range of emotions and that one emotion is not better than the other.
That's such a good point. I think we have a range of emotions. They're not good or bad. They just are. Anger can be very useful, but I'm going to say it's not just kids. We can all have days where we're just a little off and not possibly know why. And just allowing you or letting children know that it's okay, but acknowledge it. And then just try to let it go. But for so long, you're a child. You go outside, you get on your bike, you fall. You go inside crying. They're there. Okay, sit down, have a cup. Okay, oh, they're there. I'll turn on your favorite cartoons. Or let's go get you a toy. Or why can't you just say, oh, that's awful. Oh, are you done feeling that now? Are you starting to feel a little better? That's a much better way to handle it than supplant whatever they're feeling. Oh, I'm sad. Get me a cookie. Or I'm hurt. Give me my best show. It's such an odd trade-off. Instead of teaching them how to deal with the emotions. And I've said this before in different conversations, but if you watch gazelles or a zebra or whatever, they're in herds. In the whole herd, there are those on the periphery that are watching for danger because the lions are always ready to eat, right? And all of a sudden, they'll get a wind of something and let everybody else know, and they all run hell for leather and gone. They're all gone. And then they get to a place where the outriders have decided that this is safe. And if you watch them, every single animal from tip of the nose to the tail, they shimmy. And that's getting rid of those feelings, those emotions. They're letting it flow and go.
Yes.
And then they just go back to grazing or whatever they're doing. And they don't have it all pent up. We get everything, you know, we save it up, especially when we're told, oh, don't be sad, or oh, don't be angry, or oh, it can't hurt anymore, which is not true. Yes, you can. But all of those things that you're told to just bottle stuff up, and then they wonder why you get to be adults and adults explode all over the place.
Yeah.
Like, oh, we pop popcorn. If you put that much pressure, over time, something's going to explode. And again, if we just talked about it and explained when we're young humans that it's okay. And not everybody is even keel every day.
Yes.
Not very often.
I know. It reminds me, too, of just the importance of talking about our feelings and our imperfections, right? Because I think sometimes too, we are afraid to go there because we don't want to admit to any mistakes we've made, or we don't want to admit to something maybe that we're not as good at, or we don't want to admit that we're having a tough time in our recovery. And so I think similar to the ways in which we need to feel more comfortable sharing our emotions, I think we also need to create more spaces for people to share the imperfections of mental health struggles, recovery, whatever it might be.
Yeah, totally agree with you. And sometimes I think it's really good to check in with the people, I say in your tribe, but the people close to you. Yeah. Okay. I asked how you were and you said fine, but it didn't sound fine. How are you really? And then just be ready to actually listen, because I find that we're always so ready to offer help, to tell them how to fix it, to change what's going on, instead of just listening. If you talk to young people and kids, when they want you to listen, they just want your ears. So I have said to my grandkids and a few other people, you matter to me so much, I will listen. I will duct tape my mouth so that all I can do is listen, if that's what it takes for you to feel safe enough to talk.
Mm-hmm.
And so I always go to bent humor for everything. It's who I am. But I really, truly mean it, because sometimes people need that safety of knowing you're not going to try and fix it. You're not going to give them 42 other things to do. They just want to be seen.
Yes. And sometimes your presence and your ears are just what they need. And I think, yeah, just having someone to listen can make all the difference. And I think, too, I've come to really appreciate people who listen, but then who also share their own vulnerabilities with me, because then it makes me feel less alone. And it also helps me to feel like I can trust that person because they're willing to go there. They're willing to share their own struggles, not in the sense that they divert all the attention away and put it on them, but that they want to have this be a back and forth where you can feel comfortable talking and sharing and you feel less alone.
And that there is the crux, is feeling less alone, knowing that there's that camaraderie. That, oh, well, yeah, I've fallen in a puddle too. Like, that has happened. And that is, I think that is reinforcing that you are truly there for them. Unlike when you immediately go to fix it or tell them to change the subject, or when are you going to get over this? Those kinds of things, which I just think are so painfully dismissive.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I agree. And yeah, they can leave people feeling really misunderstood, because I think there's a lot of accusations that sometimes happen when you open up.
Yeah.
And people think, why can't you just get back on track? Or why can't you just make the choice to be better or to do better? But of course, when it comes to mental health, it's not about choice alone. There's a lot of other factors that play into it.
Absolutely. And it's never that cut and dry. We are human by nature. We are imperfect. And another thing I've often said, if humans were perfect, there'd be two of them. End of segment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there aren't any species that there are only two. As there are differences. We have our differences. And I think that's what makes us interesting to each other.
Yes, I agree.
So the book should be out, you said, August.
So it comes out August 5th, but it's available for pre-order on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, and you can pre-order it, and then it'll come to your doorstop August 5th. But yeah, then it'll be in bookstores come August, which will be really exciting.
Oh my God, yeah, you must be so excited. Yes. We will make sure that all our Mallory's information is down below on podcast. And we will also have a link so you can pre-order the book. I'm really looking forward to reading it for sure. I thank you so much for coming and being our guest today. I always ask our guests, if you have one thing you could leave the audience with, lesson learned, a little tip you use every day, or some tweak that you think is useful, what would you like to leave the audience?
That's such a beautiful question. For me, I've been thinking a lot about this concept of more recovery, and I think that's really helpful for people to consider, because sometimes it's hard to know, what does recovery actually mean? What does full recovery look like? And so anytime I make a choice that is in service of my recovery, I think, oh, there's more recovery, right? And more recovery might mean 1% one day. It might mean 6% the next day. It can be hard to quantify, but I think it's important to recognize those little moments when we have chosen more recovery for ourselves, because over time, that will lead to something bigger and greater. And so recognizing those little tiny moments along the way, I think can help us to feel like we're making progress, even if we've just put one foot in front of the other on a particular day. So aiming for more recovery is something that I'd love for listeners to think more about. And it's been helpful for me.
That's absolutely beautiful. I love that. Something along those lines, I think what my spiritual advisor said, we are like onions. There's always a little more to unpack. And I think if we maintain our curiosity, then more recovery is always possible.
Yeah, and it suggests this idea that it's something that you can keep working at and something that can actually be a moment of growth. I think sometimes we think this is a slog, like I'm going to be dealing with this for the rest of my life. But in some ways, if you think about it from a standpoint of curiosity and growth, you can think, no, this is something I get to continue learning from, and I can keep growing as a person if I keep aiming for more of this recovery. So I tend to think of it in that way, and it feels like a lighter load in some ways.
See, I love that. I believe I look for 1% better every day. I want to learn something every single day. And some days it's pretty bizarre, but it's learning.
Yes, it's all important.
Absolutely. I thank you so much, Mallory, for coming and joining us today. And as I said, we'll make sure everything is available below. In the meantime, as per usual, make the very best of your today, every day. And we'll see you next time. Bye for now.
Thank you for being here for another inspiring episode of Suicide Zen Forgiveness. We appreciate you tuning in. Please subscribe and download on your favorite service and check out SZF's YouTube channel or Facebook community. If you have the chance to leave a 5-star rating or review, it'd be greatly appreciated. Please refer this to a friend you know who may benefit from the hope and inspiration from our guests. Suicide Zen Forgiveness was brought to you by the following sponsors. Trul Social Media, the digital integration specialists. Let them get you rocking page one in the search results. Canada's keynote humorist, Judy Kroon, motivational speaker, comedian, author, and stand-up coach at Second City. Judy has been involved for over a decade in the City Street Outreach Program in Toronto. Do you have a story to share? Do you know someone you think would be a great guest? Please go to szf42.com. And for our American listeners, that's szf42.com. Thank you for listening, and we hope to see you again.